is really going to be something. Well, hey, Jaden, thank you so very much for joining us on this special edition. It seems like these past four episodes have been special edition. Well, next month we'll go back to our normal type of format, I think. Whatever that is, you know, we're still learning.
I don't know what that is. Yeah. It's just, yeah.
It's still evolving, and that's what I like about it. But thanks for being a part of it. I really appreciate it.
Hey, my pleasure.
Bye, man. It's twitter.com/TheEternal. Find out more about Jaden there. Hey, oh, wow, this is special. Here's someone that was very influential about changing the public opinion of pinball. Let's get Roger Sharp on the line. Open it up, Keith. Chicago, Illinois! Roger Sharp. No, things are falling off. My voice is rocking. I'm like, va-voom, va-voom. I don't know if you remember Felix the Cat. Oh, you're unplugged from the board. Keith, okay, now you're back on. Okay. It ruined my joke. The coolest mustache in the biz, Roger Sharp. Roger, thank you for joining us when we talk games today.
My pleasure.
Now, you do remember Vavoom?
I do, as a matter of fact. I am of a certain era where that is memorable.
And that is relevant, and especially relevant to today's youth. Never heard of him. Now, you are the only person we could think of to provide the gaming glue between pinball and video games. In fact, your skill and approach actually helped save pinball in 1976 from being outlawed by certain bureaucrats. And some refer to you as the anti-Lucas, at least by some, I mean me. Now, you were on the Williams team for many of the projects that Steve Ritchie talked about earlier in our show, and your position at Midway had you involved with all of the top titles that touched just about every gamer, I think, in the United States and worldwide, the Cruisin' Series, Mortal Kombat 3, NBA Hangtime, to name a few, plus the very, very cool tables that you helped create for Game Plan. And on our show, we have programmers, we have designers, we have producers, we have company owners, executives, competitive gamers, and we have people that are just famous and well-known for being involved around the gaming community. You tie in as a fan, a competitor, a marketer, and a creator.
Yeah, it's kind of strange as you start laying it all out. I wonder how I could have all done that in the limited past three decades, but I guess there was enough time.
How did you get started in your path to your career and where you are now?
Well, simply said, back when I was growing up, there were no video games. I effectively grew up pinball deprived. And I say that because I think that having been in that situation as a child and not really being exposed to the games, when I was able to encounter them later in life, they had much more of an impact on me. And as I wrote in my book, the first time I played any kind of a coin-operated amusement game was probably about when I was 5 or 6, out on holiday vacation with my parents in California, and started playing these games, and started playing pinball machines. And actually, the game that I reference in the book, where they talk about me being on a... I talk about me being on an orange crate, was actually an old baseball game with a man-run unit.
Sure.
Pinball machines back then were kind of like overwhelming to me, but the baseball game I absolutely knew. Press this, ball is coming, swing, you know, try to hit the ramp for the home run. It was incredibly intuitive. Fast forward, and I have an older sister, and she went to the University of Illinois, and on those kind of family weekends, we traveled down, and there'd be games in some of the places where we'd go to eat, and it was like, wow, these are kind of neat. But growing up in Chicago, where games were outlawed, it wasn't until I went to college that I started playing pinball. And then, I don't know, maybe destiny has a fate for all of this, but started playing, leave Wisconsin to travel to New York after I graduate to start my professional career, which was in advertising, and lo and behold, New York City has no pinball machines. So I kind of went from total ignorance and unfamiliarity to effectively, and I was on a 5-year plan in school, 5 years of, you know, almost nonstop pinball playing, to then, okay, I'm now at famine again.
Mm-hmm.
And the only difference at that stage of my life was that I had the knowledge of pinball, and hence I had the desire to want to play it. And other than driving to New Jersey or Connecticut or other places, and I was living in Manhattan, there was no place to play. I mean, eventually I found a place in the village that had games operating in the back room, kind of illegally, but when I found myself over at GQ magazine, I had an opportunity to effectively assign myself a story, and the reason and motivation for assigning myself a story was to not get a game for free, but to be able to find somebody somewhere that I could buy a pinball machine from. That was the sole motivation.
Wow.
And in a, I guess, serendipitous way, doing research at a library, finding out there were no books, no anything, and an offhanded comment that I made to the editor about needing probably a little bit more time because there's no books in the subject, and his comment back being, well, you think you know so much, why don't you write a book? And that's really how everything started. So I go back to it. I mean, I have said it on numerous occasions how blessed I feel to have been involved and around the industry for, God, now 36 years, you know, over half my life, and to have come to it as a total foreigner, you know, without any preconceived notions about anything, without any familiarity whatsoever, which I think is potentially why the pinball book has endured now for, what, over 30 years from when it was published. I mean, it really became a love affair between me and the games, and more importantly, between me and the people I was able to meet and befriend. And from all eras, you know, look, the timing couldn't have been better to meet somebody like Harry Williams and to kind of relive his life with him. Steve Kordak. Thank God Steve is still around, but the late Norm Clark. You know, Sam Ginsberg, Herb Jones. I mean, the list kind of goes on and on. People who were there back in the early 1930s who kind of started it all. And I think that, again, if I had grown up with pinball machines, trust me, none of this, I believe, in all honesty, would have ever happened. I would have just kind of taken them for granted, would have encountered them when I did, and it would have not been anything special. But, again, there's no games here in New York. If I get a game, I can have it in my apartment, and I have a pinball machine, and I have to start driving on the weekends out to New Jersey for miles upon miles to play pinball.
Sure.
And the timing as well corresponded, if you look at it historically. And I know you mentioned that Ralph Baer had been on. 1974 was a time where, you know, video was really still in its embryonic stages, so I kind of was at a crossroads in time with what was going to be happening and what was beginning to evolve for that form of leisure time entertainment. So I guess in some ways I was there for the start of it all, and specifically for video, for home computers and all the rest of it. And then, again, gratefully through the eyes of people who were there back in the 30s, being able to feel as if I was in the room with Harry Mabbs and Alvin Gottlieb seeing, you know, the first flipper bat being wired. Because everything was just, you know, so vivid as they recounted their various stories.
Now, you say that you came at this from an advertising background. Were you involved in advertising in Manhattan? How did you get called? Oh, I see. And how did you get called before the 1976 New York City Council?
Well, I started off in advertising as a copywriter and an account exec. And
oh, that's right, GQ Magazine.
I guess I've always kind of fancied myself as a writer, and as I joked back then, I was tired of losing people after a headline and a paragraph. I really wanted to do more writing, and through a process of abject rejections, sending out a letter to 55 different magazines asking what what are the procedures to submit a story for your magazine? And I got three responses back. Two were on my own letter saying thanks but no thanks, and one was on a small piece of paper with a person's name on it saying, if you know anything about tires, bicycles, wheels, or cars, call this number. And a week later, I was in the offices with the editor and managing editor of GQ magazine asking me to do a piece on everything anybody ever wanted to know about 10-speed bicycles.
Ah, I see.
And the piece ran in 1975. I think it was like the March issue.
A lot of Schwinn's in there, I guess?
Yeah, probably back then. but started in 1974 and made the switch when things in advertising slowed down, and was given an opportunity to become the associate editor at GQ. My comment when the offer was made was, I know nothing about magazines. And the comment back was, you know how to type and you know how to write. Now, 1974, that makes sense. that would not happen now. So again, I think in some ways I've been blessed in being in the right place at the right time for whatever my career path has been and whatever my life legacy ultimately becomes as well. And I took on the mantle of being associate editor and then managing editor, and I was there for 8.5 years. So that's kind of how it all started now. Having said that, to answer your question more directly, I did a piece that appeared in the winter Living It Up issue of GQ magazine, where Pinball was a part of what became a much more expansive piece on, we'll call it interactive entertainment, although it wasn't then, but touting the upcoming new Laserdisc players. I only had to wait 10 years for that. And some of the other, you know, groundbreaking technology, some of it that never came to pass and others that did, far too ahead of my time. There were no home video game systems, so my idea was buy an arcade game. Buy this sit-down eight-player, you know, tank game or whatever from Atari.
Sure.
And part of that, again, were pinball machines, one from each of the three main companies. Sorry to Chicago Coin, there was no room for an extra fourth, if I remember correctly, and I could be totally wrong, and maybe all four were in there. Anyway, the GQ piece came out. At that point in time, I had already gotten a book publisher interested in wanting to do my pinball book. And my art director on my book was also the art director for the New York Times Arts and Leisure section, which is their major entertainment section in the Sunday newspaper, and worked it out where I did a piece in the New York Times. And that piece ran around Christmas time of 75. The net result from that was my being contacted by the New York State Association for the Coin Machine Industry, asking me if I would be willing to testify on behalf of getting pinball legalized in New York. So the outgrowth was the ability, and again, I was in control of that, of saying, all right, I'm going to assign myself a story to do pinball machines.
Right.
So we're still going back to the fact that it's all motivation.
Right.
Need to find people, meet people, buy a game, which I ultimately wound up doing.
But, very good. I was going to ask that. Okay.
But then the New York Times piece, book publisher, okay, got to start plotting that out and how I want to deal with it. And now this phone call comes out of the blue. And by then, I had already been to my first major trade show. I was starting to make inroads in regard to introducing myself to the industry. By that point in time, I was a fairly accomplished player, so that carried a lot more weight. In addition, and it's probably faltering a little bit now, but I have a photographic memory. So the stories that I was being told of the people that I was meeting kind of all sunk in. So it was all of these things, and suddenly I was being introduced as, here's the greatest player you'll ever see, and ask him anything about pinball machines. He will tell you. He'll tell you, you know, the day and the week that it was done and who designed it and whatever. I don't know if I became a novelty necessarily, but with all of that supporting me was the outreach for me to appear before the city council in New York, which happened in April of 1976, and to discuss the history, what had I uncovered. The fact that I was working on this definitive book detailing and chronicling the industry, and then to talk more specifically about the skill aspects of pinball, and to see if they could overrule what had been on the books for, at that point, 35 years, going back to 1941.
Wow.
So that's how I found myself before the city council.
And was it really that calling what alley the ball would go into, the plunger shot, that changed their minds in addition to anything else? Or?
Yeah, it really was. I think that was a turning point. And again, I mean, in retrospect.
It's amazing.
And the only reason that I did it, and you know, I discussed the geometry of the game. And you know, understand, no speech back then, the basic pinball sounds, talking about a bank shot, single-player Gottlieb game. And it was a question of saying that there's a reason and a rationale as to why this is laid out the way that it is laid out and what these features correspond to thematically. And I forget if I played like one ball and kind of cradled the ball and called my shots and aimed and did things. It was like, I think, very impressive when I think about it. But to me, that was like, I can do this in my sleep.
Right, right.
But the key ingredient, and whether it was the second ball, I think, in all honesty, it's probably the third ball. But I played to kind of talk my way through it, pointing things out. And before I pulled back the plunger, I remembered encountering, and again, if I really look at my life and kind of detail it and take it apart, everything was meant for a particular reason. I mean, even down to what I'm about to tell you. In traveling around to do research for the pinball book and to take pictures and whatever else, James Hamilton, the photographer on the book, and myself were in Chicago on one of the multiple visits that we made. And I was still based in New York, as was James. And we were out in one of the suburbs, a suburb called Skokie, and they had, I think it was called Old Orchard Bowl, but it was a bowling alley. And, okay. And for whatever reason, stopped at the bowling alley. Could have just driven by. Stopped at the bowling alley. There's games here. Great. Let's take some pictures. Let me play a little bit. And I went over, and all of the games had no plungers. And I found out later on that the reason for no plungers was that the township of Skokie determined that that was the gambling portion of the pinball machine. So they put in an automatic shooter, which, trust me, back in 1975, did not play like the automatic shooters that we had in the 90s.
Right, right.
And I just thought, God, this is just terrible. The ball's, kind of it goes to the same place, the same lethargic momentum or lack thereof.
There's a glue.
So before I was ready to pull back the plunger on the third ball in the courtroom, that came back to me. And it was like this, I don't know if you want to call it an epiphany, but, and gentlemen, even to the extent of the plunger, and, we have these little gradient lines, and these lines show, how far back to pull the plunger to send the ball up, and if you take a look at the top, there's five lanes, it's a five-ball game. Each of the lanes correspond to hopefully me being accurate enough to pull back that plunger so I can, by the fifth ball, land in that last lane. And I then proceeded to say, and if I do this exactly right, it will go down that center lane. And I pulled back the plunger, looked as the ball went up, hit the rubber stopper, made its arc down, and without having to nudge the game or anything else, the ball found its way straight down like a swish in basketball. Nothing but net, straight down the center lane. That's when the gruff-looking fellow in the picture, for those who have seen it in my book, kind of turned around, all right, that's it. We've seen enough.
That's fantastic. That's a great
story. So that was truly the turning point in all of it. And I think that if I would have thought better of it, I might have said, I'll get close. So, right. Some people have equated it with the Babe Ruth moment of pointing out at Wrigley Field and hitting the home run where he was pointing. I don't know if I could have done two in a row.
Sure, sure. And what table was that you were demonstrating on?
It was a Gottlieb single player called Bankshot.
And what was your first pin that you ended up getting out of the article?
First one I wound up getting was Buckaroo.
Oh, fantastic.
I played cowpoke in school, which is the out-of-ball version, and I'm hoping I'm remembering correctly, so it's a senior moment. And I had also played hurdy-gurdy, which was Central Park. Those are the two primary games that I really latched on to. Central Park hurdy-gurdy was the first game I ever turned.
Wow.
Absolutely loved the game, was good at it after being terrible, and trust me, I started off as one of those idiots who would put his money in, pull back the plunger, and start flipping wildly.
Both at the same time.
Both at the same time. The ball's not even close to being somewhere down the middle of the play field. It's still bouncing around, and I am just flipping madly. And then, there are these little discoveries that happen. Oh, wait. I can wait until the ball gets closer to the flipper. Okay, let me flip madly and wildly now that the ball is closer to the flipper. Wait a second. If it's only on the right side, I don't have to flip the left flipper. I mean, it was this self-teaching process of getting comfortable with the game. And the one game that vexed me was cowpoke, the roto target in the center.
Sure.
Trying to get the four so I could get as many out-of-balls as you could, get it up to 10 and play it. And the turning point for me was a fraternity brother. There was a burger joint on State Street in Madison, Wisconsin. And lunch break, I'm there and I'm watching him have his hamburger. He has the plate on top of the machine, right by the bottom arch. French fries, hamburger, soda, and a cigarette. He is cradling the ball. He's playing. He's racking up at-a-balls, shooting, playing, and he's eating his entire lunch. Had his soda, finished his cigarette, turned to me and said, here, I got to get back to class. And I've joked about the fact that I drained all 10 balls before he left Burgerville, which I think was the name of the place. I have a feeling that I probably drained them a couple of blocks later because I had not necessarily accomplished the level of expertise that eventually I was going to. And that became one of the principal motivations for me, was to be able to play, and specifically play cowpoke and have my lunch. And I did. But it was one of those games. I got to the point on Hurdy-Gurdy where I could basically turn it every time I played it, which made for a very long playing experience.
Sure.
Majorettes was out at around the same time. Great single-player game. Subway, which was Crosstown. All these Gottlieb single-player Adderall games. And cowpoke was the one where, you know, I could have those peak moments, and then other times it was like, darn it, I just can't do it. So when I had the opportunity and met up with a distributor in New Jersey that I had befriended and said, hi, I want a game, and I know what I want. I want, you know, Central Park, Hurdy-Gurdy if you got it. And he took us back in the warehouse. I was there with James Hamilton. And he said, here. And sitting right next to it was Buckaroo.
Nice.
And I was like, wow, you know what? Let me take the game that caused me the most consternation as a player, and not the one that I know I can play blindfolded. And James wound up buying the Central Park, and I wound up buying the Buckaroo.
And then you went on to become a pinball wizard, I guess, in the 70s and 80s. How long did that last? Were you ever number one? I don't know everything that I asked the questions. I know that your sons sort of took that mantle, but
yes, they have.
How far did you get?
I think back then there really were no competitions. There was a gal by the name of Millie McCarthy in the state of New York who was running tournaments. I didn't believe in playing competitively.
Okay.
Which may sound strange. I just played for the love of wanting to play the game, and if somebody said, hey, Roger, let's play, okay, let's play, and I want you to do well, and I'm going to do as well as I can. The turning point came about 1977, 78, when Bally did the Super Shooter Tournament. Up to that point in time, yeah, I could basically destroy everybody and anybody that I encountered. I'm sure that, you know, on any given day, on any given machine, you know, somebody could have bested me, but I think that everybody, at least within the industry, because there wasn't this community that existed outside of the industry. So I don't know. I mean, you'd go to a particular location, an arcade or wherever else, and you didn't have games where you put your initials in. It was just like, all right, sure. So you have to beat 8,452. All right, I can do that. So, I mean, for me, that was just the love of wanting to play the game, whatever that game might have been, and squeezing the most out of it that I possibly could. During Super Shooter, and I got involved with it, I guess as a judge, at that time I had switched over to being editor of Video Games Magazine, and we were kind of like one of the sponsors of the event, and I helped line up the games for the finals in Chicago at the Playboy Towers.
Okay.
And proceeded to watch a fellow by the name of Ken Lunsford win this first national tournament. I guess there were about a million players who competed to qualify, and there was a top 20 that were flown into Chicago, ages 11 to, like, I want to say 32, with one gal, and national media everywhere. I mean, this was a spectacle beyond belief. And there was a fellow by the name of Joe Grillo, who just played exceptionally well throughout that weekend, who wound up losing at the end. And I left there thinking, there's something wrong. Now, before I left leaving, there was something wrong. There was a celebrity tournament, and they had Bill Murray there and the late Gilda Radner and Walter Payton, Paul Warfield, I mean, a whole slew of sports celebrities and other personalities, and there was a celebrity tournament. Why? Well, celebrity tournament to entertain everybody and to have a chance to compete against Roger Sharp.
Aha! Uh-huh.
And it was Walter Payton and I playing on Power Play, the old Bobby Orr-themed Valley game, and we were supposed to play. I think it was best 2 out of 3. And somewhere I probably still have the ripped sweater because Walter was on his machine and I was on mine. We had set it up, and I told the guys from the competition, I said, "All right, this one's for you," because I wasn't competitive. I mean, it wasn't as if, you know, I wanted to destroy people and play pinball.
Sure, sure.
If I could beat you by a little bit, that was enough. All right, and I'll goof around. I'll make some trick shots, and I'll do some other impossible things just because I enjoy showing off. in this particular instance, it was like, all right, I'll step up and show you guys. And I think Walter played about 2.5 games, and I was still somewhere on my first ball. Maybe the second, when Bill Murray came behind me because he was doing the play-by-play. And there may be, who knows, there may be some video around that I haven't seen since that time. I'm sure that there are some pictures, but one will find me literally being brought to my knees while I'm still playing as Bill Murray takes the collar of my sweater and rips it to get me away from the game, and I would not release the flippers. So, effectively, I wound up beating Walter, and I think the guys are appreciative. But, fast-forwarding just a bit, I really thought that, and taking nothing away from Ken Lunsford, that he was not the right player to have won in terms of being the most skillful, and the net result was Steve Epstein, who became a very dear friend, the owner of the world-famous Broadway Arcade in New York City, which, trust me, if there's ever a chance to be able to interview and talk to him, Steve has stories that will amaze you, and the impact and influence that he had in a major market like New York City after I was able to open the gates to let pinball in is really unheralded and unrivaled. And Steve and I became very, very quick and fast friends. The net result was, because of the super shooter experience, creating PAPA, Professional and Amateur Pinball Association, and playing pinball. Now, having said that, let's go back one more step, and thank you for indulging me.
Love it.
So, in advance of Super Shooter, there was a fellow by the name of Joe Schick that was doing a feature for Games Magazine to kind of tie in. Games was also another one of the sponsors, along with, I guess it's now Nissan, but they used to be Datsun and Pioneer and a whole slew of other companies. Mm-hmm. And Joe Schick's purpose, when he contacted me, was he wanted to play me in pinball. And he wanted to play me because the premise of his feature was going to be that he defeated the world's best player. And we had set it up to be at the Broadway Arcade, 52nd and Broadway in Manhattan, on a Sunday. The ground rules were really simple because I wanted it to be as fair as possible. At that time, you had some of the Spanish and Italian companies with games. So Playmatic, Racel, along with Bally, Chicago Coin, I mean, the list kind of goes on and on. But Steve's population of pinballs at the corner store was, I want to say, probably in excess of about 100 machines, all in great functioning order. So the way I'd set it up, and Joe agreed, was I said, look, I don't want you to think that I have an advantage. I'm going to do little pieces of paper with each manufacturer's name on it. If you pick Bally, you can take any Bally game in this entire place and pick it. If I pick Gottlieb, I take whatever Gottlieb game. I said, all right, that's fair. All we're doing is just picking a manufacturer's name. So I think Joe picked first. He actually came with an entourage. And it was Steve there because he opened up a little bit early on that Sunday morning. And a dear friend of ours, a fellow by the name of Lionel Martinez, who was a film editor, film director, one of the pinball regulars, one of the people who actually helped me as I designed and defined what ultimately became PAPA. And the first game started, Joe has his cheering section and whatever else, and it's like, God, this is terrible. And he beat me. Beat me terribly on the first game. And literally, Steve and Lionel grabbed me, threw me right back, took me outside. Said, what the hell are you doing? You can beat this guy. And it's like, well, I mean, people are cheering. I mean, God, yeah, I don't want to do this. Well, you're going to have to do it. Otherwise, he's writing a piece that he's beat the world's best player.
Right.
So it was like, all right, fine. So I went back in and proceeded to absolutely destroy and devastate him. And Joe's response, after all was said and done, I mean, was like, I don't know what I'm going to write now. I mean, God. And I said, well, if you just asked me, I would have let you write whatever piece you wanted. I said, this has been the worst time of playing pinball I've ever experienced. I really didn't like it. I mean, I wanted to destroy you. And I wasn't playing pinball the way I liked to play it. We could have played it friendly.
Right.
And we became fast friends after that, trust me. But during that time, whatever number of hours it was unbearable for me. So I never really wanted to compete on that level. And I held my sons back. You mentioned them before. Mm-hmm. I guess they're ranked, what, fourth and sixth in the world, or third and fifth, whatever it is. And they have become incredibly skillful players and have helped, I guess, revive pinball in a way that nobody had ever expected it was going to be possible with the establishment of the IFPA, International Flipper Pinball Association, which is now global and grows by leaps and bounds with the pinball rankings. But I think that, you know, I remember the second Papa that was in running New York, and Steve had me kind of lead it off for the cameras and all the rest of it. And we had a lineup of games, and I had a particular approach to the setting up of the tournament and how things had to be. And all right, and here's the announcer, and, you know, going to lead it off, and, you know, it's kind of like this grand marshal opening, and proceeded to play all eight games and just did terrible. And I'm like, God, this is a waste. And asked the players if they minded if I would play in the tournament. No, come on. And I came close to qualifying, but I also realized, and as Steve pointed out, you wind up choking, Roger. And my sons subsequently told me the same. It's like, yeah, you know, I'm still not comfortable with it. And
just
I have played competitively. I have won tournaments. I have done well. But there's not the same kind of deliberate, methodical approach to pinball competitively as there is for other people. And more importantly, when I developed as a player, the games were different. The technology was different.
Sure.
And forgetting about the fact that I'm now older and there's not necessarily a senior circuit for pinball as there is in golf, you know, I don't have the reflexes I used to have. I obviously, admittedly, don't have the same level of concentration. You know, I have my moments where suddenly it's like, wow, you know, to beat the number one player in the world, I guess it was a year ago in the spring at ASI, Keith Elwin. Yeah, I mean, I was on my game. I got to show what I used to be able to do, but those times were infrequent. It's kind of like, you know, Arnold Palmer or Jack Nicklaus teeing off in a golf tournament. They kind of know what they can do, but they're not going to compete. So that's, I guess, a very long-winded answer to the level and quality of gamesmanship and skill that I have now and what I used to have.
Right on. Now, well, let's take that compartment, put it to the side, and let's go into the other compartments. Did you start at working at Williams first, and then Midway, I guess? Is that how that worked? Or
I'd been around, obviously, the industry going back to 74.
Okay.
I had designed games for Game Plan.
Mm-hmm.
I had designed a game for Williams, Barracuda, that came out in 1982. Couple of years later than it was supposed to. I had actually done some design work for Gottlieb that never made the light of day. So, I mean, I'd kind of been around all of the companies at various points in time, from Atari, amazingly, to Gottlieb and to others. There were very close situations of my going to work within the industry and still at GQ. But, you know, I also wrote other books and did other things. So in 1988, I wound up getting a phone call, and I had been in touch with Williams probably for about the previous 8 or 9 months. I had contacted them because of two things. One, I wanted to create a consumer magazine, and I wanted to do the first issue for free, and I wanted that premier issue to go out in pinball machines, figuring that the audience would then get key issues, see that they like it, and I could launch my little publishing venture. The other thing was approaching Williams with a design and a license for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles back in 1987.
Okay.
Before it really kind of hit.
Yeah.
So when I got a phone call in, I guess, February or March of 1988, I thought the callback was for, okay, we doing my game? We doing my license? Are we doing my magazine? What's going on? And instead, they made me an offer to come work for the company as a director of marketing. So I started at Williams in April of 1988 as the director of marketing. As I moved my family from Connecticut, which is where I was then living, to the Chicago area around 4th of July weekend, and I had heard the rumors, there had been rumblings about what I'm going to say, but I really didn't think it was going to happen. And I called from Pennsylvania just to say hi. In Pennsylvania, making progress. And Marty Glazeman, who was the vice president of marketing and sales, said to me, well, it's true, we have purchased the amusement game assets division, if you will, of Bally. So we have Bally Midway. And it was like, okay, do I turn back or do I keep coming? And he said, you keep coming, need you to be here on such and such a day instead of, so I need to get back sooner. And no, there's no more money, and yes, you have twice the responsibility. So by, I think everything was finalized, maybe the mid or latter part of July of 1988, and I'm sure the people can go back through files and things and be more accurate. But suddenly I was the director of marketing for Williams Bally Midway.
Wow.
And stayed there, I guess, through all of the changes. You know, I was there at a time where Williams was just re-entering video, with Eugene Jarvis heading up a group of folks with the first digitized graphics game called NARC.
Sure.
And I was there until 2000, and then came back full-time for WMS Gaming slot machines in 2001.
Wow. So you.
So any and all licensed themes going back to 1988, pinball and or video, were ones that I wound up acquiring and negotiating, working hand in hand with the design teams and everybody else, approvals and whatever. I think I totaled it at one time because it had been asked. There's about 180 projects.
Wow. So you were in through the good times and the bad times. I guess it was pretty much a rocky road all along the way, a big roller coaster, I guess.
Well, I mean, let's face it. You know, pinball had its own stages, if you will, of rebounding. There had been, obviously, lean times in the early 80s, a resurrection of sort in the mid-80s, and then, you know, kind of gained some momentum. Technology changed a bit. Dot matrix displays, more speech, different style of artwork, a little bit more realistic, better music and fidelity, more features that people hadn't experienced before. So the landscape of pinball changed. Being around with video games, which, again, in an interesting way, had had its explosive growth, and I was there for it, in the late 70s, and then the rapid deflation back around 1981, 1982, when everything dissipated. And we're talking about not only coin-op, but more importantly, the home market.
Sure.
With the collapse of Coleco.
And Magnavox. And
Magnavox. And Magnavox was an issue just because of Casey Munchkin and lawsuits. But the IPF Imagination Machine, the PC Junior coming out, so on that side, the VIC-20, pre-Commodore. You look at PCs and where they were in their infancy, and again, I was there at that opening, on through to the point that you just said, Magnavox, Bally Arcade, 2600, and the ill-fated 7800, the 400 and the 800 from Atari. I mean,
sure.
All of these things, and the crossover, and the confusion in the marketplace, and product that should never have been developed from a software standpoint. So, fast forward to, you know, 1988 and NARC, and now it's a brave new world. There are things that are going to be happening, and Midway games such as Arch Rivals from Brian and Jeff at Game Refuge, and things such as Smash TV, and then the very first licensed video product, NBA Jam, on through to, you know, 1992, the breakthrough with Mortal Kombat, and what we were able to turn that into. When the guys first approached me, John Tobias and Ed Boone, John's idea was he wanted to get Jean-Claude Van Damme, and it would be a Jean-Claude Van Damme game. And when I couldn't get that for them, we sat down and I said, well, why don't we just develop our own mythology, create characters, and obviously they created some fabulous characters, and I need a backstory, because I was doing the PR as well. Give me who are these people? Do I care about them? Give me a history. And John had always wanted to do a comic book, so I was like, all right, give me a screen on the game. Ed was nice enough to open up a P.O. box. My assistant, Alice Metro, and her sister, Jeanette, were great to support it. And I did a comic book on the back page because I had an extra page. I was like, all right, let's do T-shirts, and reached out to a premium guy that I knew. So the very first derivative product, if you will, from Mortal Kombat was a comic book. And then the rest of it kind of just happened, again, piece by piece, step by step, with the two feature films, 220 licensed companies on board,
and
all doing Mortal Kombat stuff and generating, what, $2 billion in 1 year in revenue with a live tour, a live action series, an animated series. This kind of goes on, and the rest, as they say, is history when one looks at the evolution of Mortal Kombat. So, yes, I was there across the board, although many people think of me primarily for pinball. I'd like to think that I had as much, if not more, of an influence when it comes to video games and what wound up happening.
I take it that you were still there for Pinball 2000.
Most definitely.
What was your involvement with that, if any?
Well, I think the original brainstorming sessions and talking about the direction that we would consider taking and looking at different approaches, I kind of knew that Pat Lawler and George Gomez were off-site working on something, but they were keeping it secret.
I see.
And it was interesting. I guess I was the first person that Pat came and got when they brought it in under a drape. And George and Pat were setting it up to show it to upper management and other folks, and plugged it in, pulled away the cape, looked at it, and knew instantaneously what they had done. And I thought, oh, this is awesome. Yep,
yeah.
I got it. So the hollow pin worked for me because I remembered, you know, the old pinball games that were done before with, you know, reflective surface.
Right, right.
Looking at it, I thought it was marvelous. I thought it was inventive, and Larry DeMar and, you know, the other troops really kind of took everything to heart and to task to come up with the best solution for the operator. Is this going to be kiddable? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Is it going to be accessible to do maintenance, even if the person doesn't want access for that technician to get to the cash box? Yes, we can do that. I mean, there was like this hit list of things, and the guys attacked and solved all of them so that, you know, look, it's a mechanical device, still at all. Something is going to happen at some point in time. Well, how do you get in there to change a light bulb? Most locations, the reason that the games stay down or aren't fixed is that there's not anybody to maintain them, and the person that comes around is really coming around doing collections. And nobody wants to open up the front, because you open up the front and the cash box is exposed.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, something as remedial as that was all considered. And, yeah, I was there. Worked on all the promotion for it. I worked on all the PR.
Do you have any favorite mechanicals stepping out of the realm? You said that you first got interested in the baseball machines. Do any other mechanicals? I'm a big fan of mechanicals. I especially like the helicopter.
Okay.
And I know that we had George Gomez on a previous episode, and he talked about that he made a revamp of that helicopter game with a more modern Desert Storm type of feel to it.
Yep.
Any other type of mechanicals really pop out at you that you remember?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I mean, I remember, I think it was a rabbit and a bear game where they were on a track in the back, and it, same kind of platform format as the baseball games. Ball would come out from, you know, a center flap, and you would try to time, it wasn't a flipper, you try to time your bat so you could hit the rabbit or the bear. And you needed to finish all those off so you could keep on playing. I absolutely loved that game.
Yeah.
There were some others with, God, I know that somebody's still making them. I want to say that there were balls that seemed like they were just flying in space. You'd press a button, I think it was air or whatever.
Oh, yeah, the air.
Rubber balls.
Yeah, yeah.
And then at the appropriate time, the air would stop and the balls would fall down onto this grid. And if you could line up two or three or whatever else, that's how you, you know, won a prize or
whatever
the deal was.
Yeah, I forgot about that one.
Games like that? Yeah.
Do you remember the life-size the life-size mannequin that you'd shoot? Come on, partner!
Oh, yeah, I remember that one. Broadway Arcade had one.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, any and all of those. I mean, again, probably personal favorites would have been the Man Run unit when Mark Ritchie decided to do what eventually became Slugfest. I was all on board, and I wound up asking if there was some way we could do it as a card dispenser, so we worked out that technology, and I tied us in with Tops so that it became, in quotes, a redemption game.
Gotcha.
And it was actually the first machine that came from Williams Valley Midway with a dot matrix display.
Wow. Oh, yeah, right. Yeah.
But, yeah, so, I mean, those are some of my favorites that kind of come instantly to mind. Obviously, there seems to be a running thread as I think about my answer to you, that they have balls involved.
Uh-huh.
But gun games are always difficult for me. I love them, but I didn't have the depth perception, so I would be the idiot to be standing behind the gun trying to line up the sight as opposed to doing it the right way.
Sure.
So I couldn't do it for my right or left eye because I just couldn't. but that's something I always wanted to do. But games like Seawolf and others, the original one, mm-hmm. with a periscope where I could have both eyes.
Right.
Yes. Those were cool as heck.
Now, I spoke to George a little bit about this, and he didn't really have any knowledge about it, but you being part of the marketing team, maybe you were, and especially involved with licensings. Now, did you know about George Lucas's conspiracy to destroy pinball?
No. Okay. Do tell.
Yes.
The George Lucas story that I can say is that when I was able to secure the rights for episode one, and we had worked with Lucas before, when we decided, and we made the choice, we had the choice of either doing Star Wars or doing Indiana Jones, and I thought that Indiana Jones was a bit more fertile. Liked it. It had nothing against Star Wars, but
sure.
And the decision was made to do that, and it was an incredible, experience to go out to the ranch and then to work with everybody, and I think that that result to this day is a testament to some of the best collaborative work that Williams did in pinball. I think Indiana Jones is a great game. It has some flaws, but forgetting about that. And I think that what was fascinating was reaching back out to them, because we did have a new platform. There was going to be video. And I remember calling and talking to them and saying, okay, I cannot tell you what it is that we're doing, but I'm going to be asking you for things that you're going to say, huh? Why do you need that?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, at an appropriate time, I will reveal to you why. And the appropriate time came, and we did reveal, and we got things earlier than anybody else. We got things earlier than LucasArts did for their video game that they were doing. Wire mesh forms and all the rest of it for some of the characters, working with some of the toy companies off of their original molds. I mean, the list kind of goes on and on. Because of that, and because we kind of knew everything, all the characters and all the rest of it, we had to be quarantined.
Mm.
And the quarantine, which may be a reference to George Lucas wanting to destroy pinball, if people want to view it that way, I don't. Maybe it's another story or another myth or another urban legend. John Papaduke and Cameron and Duncan and the rest of the group were put behind locked doors. Got to work in a vacuum with all of the assets that I was gathering for them from Lucas and from the other licensing partners that nobody else could see. We had this literally sign away our lives. That if anything came about because of our recklessness, because we've revealed anything, that they would come after us and sue us.
Sure, sure.
So I think what wound up happening, and I know that Pinball Expo and some others places, I know that John has talked about it, and he doesn't come out too often to talk to people, but I think that Cameron has mentioned it. I know Duncan has, I'm sure that George has, and others. One of the things that really hurt that project was the fact that there wasn't that interactivity between the principal design team and the rest of the folks.
Mm.
However people took whatever their egos were, whatever their designs were, everybody by and large is fair game to get a new one ripped, or at least for whatever the constructive criticism was. So whether it was Dennis Nordman, John Trudeau, John Papaduke, Pat Lawler, Steve Ritchie, Mark Ritchie, Ward Pemberton, I mean, the list goes on and on, and if I've missed anybody, my apologies, but everybody's office was open, and you kind of walked through and came around and looked, and was like, eh, all right, I'm not really liking it, but, or, I mean, there was that kind of, and trust me, I'm sure that it was a lot more arched than what I just did. Between everybody and behind the closed doors, it was limited to whatever the five or six principal people were, and it was too far gone. I mean, I have been on record, and I think that John knows this, and I harbor no resentment or ill will toward John. I think that he's incredibly talented, did great work with Theater of Magic, did great work at least with the geometry of World Cup soccer, and I think that John hopefully would be the first one to absolutely acknowledge the fact that the game became the game that it became because of what Larry DeMar did with the rule set and the programming. Now, having said all of that, and Circus Voltaire, I think, was a wonderful game.
Yeah, too, great. Mm-hmm.
In terms of layout and just balance.
Sure.
Episode one was terrible. Hated it.
Well,
it wasn't what it should have been. It should have been designed and developed from the ground up, and it wasn't, because John was adamant about keeping what he had worked on for his playfield. And I don't think that it ever really did what it might have done, a la what George did so capably with Revenge from Mars.
Sure.
So I've never been a big fan of Episode One, forgetting about Jar Jar and all of that stuff. I always thought that we had an obligation to do something better, and we didn't deliver on it. Whether or not there is something as an outgrowth from that of George Lucas, you know, having some impact on destroying pinball.
Well, I know that. I know that's what it was, and that's the story I'm going to stick with. But let's talk about games that Steve, like I said, Steve was on earlier in the show. He crapped on some of my favorite, most beloved pins, and other ones he agreed with me were fantastic. But, you know, I have my reasons for liking certain pins. The ones that particularly crept on were WWF Royal Rumble. He wasn't very familiar with Royal Guard, and who would be? It's kind of obscure, but...
What, Royal Rumble?
Royal Rumble, yeah, he crapped on that one.
Oh, no, well, the only crappy part was the fact that you had too many ramps, too many areas, wasn't logically laid out in the top play field you could play forever. But you couldn't get access to it all the time. I mean, the long shot on the left to get you back up to the top or to feed over on the left side, it was okay. It was a tough, balanced, wide body.
Sure.
That had too many hidden areas, especially in the right side underneath the upper little play field. But my memory is kind of sketchy, other than the fact that the center was a decent shot that was kind of a ripoff of what we had done on Jokers and ultimately what we had done on Police Force. Does that kind of capture a little bit of the layout?
Well, that's what I tried to tell him, but, you know, it's exactly, it was not so many words.
I'm just trying to do it off the top of my head. I mean, no reference in front of me here.
Sure. I mean, what I said was, oh, I liked it. The guys jumped up and down, and there was a lot of voice.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that it was some fun stuff.
It was fun, exactly. It's a fun machine.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't as memorable as it might have been, and we actually turned down the license.
I see.
There was no interest in it.
Okay, very good. Good to know. And I also brought up Royal Guard to him, which, like I said...
Oh, wow, great game.
And, you know, this is just... That's a pretty obscure machine, I'm sure you agree, but that was a game that was close to my heart, mostly for nostalgic reasons. And I also liked King Cool. Now, you probably will poop on that.
King Cool? Yeah, King Cool was good.
Okay, he hated the backwards flipper thing happening there, the quad flips or whatever.
I mean, you got to get over that. You just think of it in the time frame of what it was when it was being done. And I think that the issue with a lot of people in this day and age when they come down hard on a particular game is that think back within the context of what was out there and what was trying to be done, and with, you know, things like King Cool, and at that time, what was it, Jungle, and some of the others that were these kind of big, loopy, lots of things happening on the sides and the center kind of being closed off. Yeah, I mean, that was just the nature of what design was.
What did you think of Hercules?
Oh, you're talking about Bigfoot?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, when it got to my Woolworths or two guys, it was rechristened Hercules, I guess.
Right. No, I understand. And Bally didn't manufacture it. I think that it was a great novelty as a pinball. You know,
not so good.
Well, interestingly, I mean, the game played like a pinball. A little bit sluggish using pool balls, obviously.
Sure.
The power stroke on the flippers and how things were lined up for the spinner and the loop around in the center and some of the other stuff in terms of just basic geometry was all there. Just cumbersome.
Yeah.
I think of it as a carnival piece.
Sure.
And back then you could do it. It's almost like asking me, what do I think of Orbiter 1? And thinking that was a pinball or a Varcon. You know, those were times where people were just kind of, you know...
Experimenting.
Grabbing at straws, wondering, what's it going to take?
Now, I've seen some of the archive footage of you and your sons. I see an Evel Knievel machine in the background there. And I told Steve I'd love to get his retelling of the Evel Knievel machine. What do you think about that pin?
I think that it would be great. I think that the more appropriate people to talk to about it would be Greg Kamik and Jim Patla. Because I know that they were kind of working on that way back when.
Mm.
I'm assuming that, and I don't know it off the top of my head, had to be either Paul Ferris or Greg Ferris who worked on the art. And to get a sense of what that was, because one of the things that I used to rock my sons to sleep with, Joshua and Zachary, would be turning on Evel Knievel and watching the light trace of Evel making the jump at the top part of the back glass.
Wow.
And I'd turn on the games, and the lights would be there. And that's how I used to rock them to sleep when we were living in a loft in New York City when they were first born.
Can I get in a time machine and come back and be your son as well, please?
Really. My comment to my sons has been, and again, I guess we've kind of covered a little bit of it, the involvement and the exposure that I had to, you know, to pinball, to video games, to board games for that matter, handhelds in the old Mattel days and Coleco days and on and on. And the boys have been surrounded by that their entire lives. And I used to say when they were younger that someday I hope that they'll appreciate that they were lucky enough to grow up with a father who was just a big kid at heart, who had all of these games and toys.
So. That's great stuff. I also asked Steve, what about the people out there? Like most of our listeners are, you know, they're video gamers. They play pinball machines, but very few of us own pinball machines, myself included. I would love to, but things never just lined up for me and never got the right table. What would you suggest? What's a great place to start? What are some of your favorite tables?
Oh, for pinball machines? I thought you were asking me what some of my favorite video games were. I've been asked the question over the years, you know, I want to get a pinball machine, what should I get? And I think that it's becoming more difficult to give the answer that I used to give, but I will try it anyway, which is try to find some places near where you might reside and go out and play pinball. Get a feel for not necessarily the specific game you're playing, but for features. Wow, I really like a game that has multiple flippers. Oh, I like a game that has multi-ball. Oh, I definitely like a game that has a ramp. I mean, start looking at what I would call the core playfield components. And if you can, start looking at why you like them and where you like them. God, you know, I like the ramp when it's on the right side, not on the left. I mean, it can be something as basic as that.
Sure.
And then there are any number of resellers and restorers that exist literally almost everywhere. Distributors in the Yellow Pages, vending machines or whatever. I guess the point I was going to say is that you want to go out and sample games, and then what you want to do is you want to be able to go out and either have identified a particular machine. I played this at the local bowling alley. I really want this. I like this. Now, the one caveat from personal experience that I recounted before is don't necessarily play the game that you know that you can play incredibly well, because the novelty is going to wear off playing it for free and having it there every single day.
Gotcha.
Play something where there's a challenge, where it's not going to take you 12 hours to play one game, the family waiting for dinner or to leave somewhere, whatever the case might be, because there isn't infinite time typically. The second game choice will be a little bit different. And then the third and the fourth, I mean, as the case might be in terms of available space. But I think that that's how I would direct somebody, unless they automatically said, I want Elvira Scared Stiff. And there are people that want to have Batman.
Sure, sure.
Okay. Fair enough. Now go out and find a Batman. Now, if it is for people who have not been totally ingrained in the world of pinball, you know, make sure you look under the hood. It's like buying a used car. Make sure there's no burn marks anywhere. Everything's kind of clean. You can get a sense, has it been out in vacation or is it privately owned? Go through all the Q&As that you would just to know that you are buying what you are buying, and ask friends and associates. Go online. I know that the news groups exist. Go to IFPA as a website and ask, you know, I've encountered such and such a game. They want X amount of dollars for it. Looks like it's in decent shape. What do you think? Go out and ask people. I was lucky when I got my Buckaroo. I was working with a distributor who was obviously going to, or maybe not obviously, but he was going to deliver it from New Jersey to my studio apartment in New York. They did not do any repair work for me, but they put me in touch with Irving Dinnerman, who became my pinball doctor.
Gotcha.
A wonderful person who is actually the father of Bobby Dinnerman. And for those in the world of video games, Bobby Dinnerman was one of the fellows who worked on Tron for Bally Midway as a video game. And Irving would make his trek in, and my collection grew from Buckaroo to then Jack in the Box and Stingray and Evel Knievel, and the list kind of goes on and on. But the things that I could not repair myself mechanically, he would come in and do the work for me.
Right on.
So you want to make sure that you can get somebody who can do some care for your game and then take care of it. Something that I wish I did more with my games, but, you know, it's not so bad to actually take the glass off and clean the play field, follow all the appropriate instructions of, you know, how to do what you're doing. Don't take soap and water to it. And, you know, just keep it all nice and happy.
Right on. What are you involved with now? What's going on? You're still in the business, right?
And I'm still in the business. I do licensing for WMS Gaming, which now is in the world of slot machines.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. So were you involved with the Creature of the Black Lagoon?
Creature of the Black Lagoon. Pinball, yes. Slot machine, no. That was from IGT. Themes such as Monopoly.
Okay.
Oz, Top Gun, Star Trek.
Great.
The list kind of goes on and on.
Well, we just got a Sands that opened up, and we're in the Lehigh Valley here. That's where I'm broadcasting from, so
okay.
We just had a Sands open up there. I'm going to go look at what's new in the licensed slot machine area.
Gotcha.
It's all
well, I think we have some exciting things from WMS that hopefully people are enjoying.
Very good. Hey, do you own a capacitance electronic disc player? The CED player?
I know. I was just trying to think. I think that I probably do. If not, I'm sure that Josh and Zach can help me.
Okay, very good. Well, the only other person I know that I think I've had on this show that has a CED player, Roger Sharp, thank you very much for being part of We Talk Games.
I enjoyed it. Thank you. And to you and your listeners, have a great time playing games.
Right on.
Be well.
Wow, Roger Sharp. Yeah, we're going to get Roger back on here again. We didn't even really delve into his love of video games at all, because he's just involved in so much. Hey, just go to International Flipper Pinball Association, IFPApinball.com, to find out more about that organization and get yourself some pinball, Lane. Keith, let's get Kyle on the line. All right. Satellite of Integrity, Kyle Von Kubik. Now, Kyle. Pinball-centric, pinball-related We Talk Games this episode. Kyle, what pinball tables have you been playing lately?